Welcome to Offline, a podcast about building a 100% online and remote expertise-driven business without the bullshit. Hosted remotely by me, Liston Witherell.
And me, Philip Morgan. You'll learn how we're building our businesses, what scares the shit out of us, and hear from our friends and experts who are building their remote businesses too. Welcome to Offline.
Philip Morgan.
Liston Witherell.
How are you, my friend?
I'm good. Before we hit record, we were talking about friendships, and you're still my friend, so I'm good. How are you?
Oh, well, isn't that sweet?
Isn't it?
I'm good. Yeah, I'm really good. I, last Thursday, finished up a very big training, a very exciting project that I gave to a very large client, and I'm both happy that it went swimmingly well, and I'm also happy that it's over. For now, there's already talk about doing other work with them. And I'm really happy that I'm getting ready to go to Italy for 2.5 weeks.
I was going to say, I'm going to hear from you more now, but now you're leaving to go to Italy.
I'm leaving you, Philip. I'm sorry. And actually, this isn't the only thing coming in the way of our friendship today, Philip.
We have an interloper.
We have an interloper. Our very first guest, Mr. Mike Julian. Mike, welcome to Offline.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I'm sorry to come between you two.
I'm kind of imagining Mike jumping out from the bushes or hiding in the drapes or something. Mike, so glad you're here with us.
I've been here all along.
That wouldn't be weird at all. So, Mike, you and I met through Kai Davis, I believe.
We did.
And one of his Slack groups. And you recently moved to beautiful Portland, Oregon. And we connected because you're here now, and I'm also here. I was already here, but that's how we connected. So, Mike, if you could take a second to introduce yourself to all of our very dear offline listeners.
Yeah. So, hi, folks. I'm Mike Julian. I'm the CEO, it's a two-person company. I am CEO and consultant for the Duck Bill Group. We help companies with very large AWS bills make them smaller and less horrifying.
Oh, I love that. So you do consulting, but you also do something else, right?
Yeah. So this is an interesting aspect of my business in that at some point a few months ago, I merged my company with my now business partner. And my company was doing consulting on monitoring applications and infrastructure stuff, as well as running a newsletter and a podcast. And through those they were financed through sponsorships. Well, my business partner, Corey, runs Last Week in AWS, a newsletter, and Screaming in the Cloud, a podcast, and was monetized the exact same way, all through sponsorships. So when we combine companies, now we have a consulting thing that we do together, but we still have these newsletters and podcasts that are run through sponsorships, which they throw off a non-trivial amount of money. So we don't just shut them down, and also they're kind of fun to do. So in essence, I kind of have two companies that I'm running at the same time with totally different audiences, but they feed on each other in weird ways.
I want to hear more about that weird feeding thing.
The weirdness about it is people who buy sponsorships are generally marketing people, sometimes product, but generally marketing. And that, in turn, sometimes leads to situations where people are wanting my advice on what I'm seeing in the market, leading to consulting. So I come in, I help them understand what the market looks like and where the opportunities are for their company, entirely based on what I'm seeing with my clients. So the newsletter money that's coming in through that is coming sponsorships and marketing, but the people reading the newsletter are the people that are paying us for AWS consulting. And through that is feeding my knowledge on what the market looks like. So they definitely feed on each other in just a really weird symbiotic way.
Yeah, that sounds almost like a virtuous cycle.
Right.
I feel like there's a ton to get into here.
We could talk about so much.
I know. Well, let me throw this at you, though. I think this would be attributed to Alan Weiss. He said, don't do a partnership unless it's a 1+1=3 situation. I'm paraphrasing, of course. Is that sort of how you looked at it, or how did you think about the whole partnership thing?
Philip, at this point, I'm trying to think, like, did you and I ever actually discuss this before we did this partnership merger? Because that was the exact line that Corey and I kept saying to each other.
Oh, weird.
We've been friends for quite some time. We've been trying to figure out, using this phrase, what is the 1+1=3 business for us?
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I'm pretty sure I saw that in like Million Dollar Consulting, one of Alan Weiss's books.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic advice. For those not familiar with the advice, it basically says that Alan, I think, was actually talking about it in the context of a joint venture, which is a limited version of a partnership. It's like a per-project partnership. And the idea is that if you were able to create $50,000 of revenue yourself, and your partner is able to create $50,000 of revenue themselves, when you come together, the business should not just be $100,000 of revenue. It should be much more than that. So having two people together should be more or better than the sum. So Corey and I had been trying to figure this out for a while, and like easily a year. And our initial thought was, it's not going to be monitoring because he doesn't care. And it's not going to be AWS because I don't care. So clearly it's a third thing. And finally, Corey calls me up one day. Like, I had just left the gym. It's like super early morning. And he's like, I just got out of the shower. I have an idea. And I'm like, oh God, do I want to know what it is?
Yeah, you always wonder when someone's been thinking about you in the shower, what were they thinking?
Right. Like, I was a little worried. So he's like, you should come join my company and like run the company for me. I'm like, I'm sorry, what? I don't know anything about this. So we went back and forth for a while. I talked to a lot of my own trusted advisors and asked them, like, this is what we're thinking about doing. And like, it's not an immediate no for me, but it took me a while to get to yes. And looking back, it's hard to say why I hesitated so much, but I guess it really comes down to, if I'm doing this thing, then that means stopping doing something else. And if I'm going to stop doing this monitoring consulting stuff, then who am I? What is my primary skill? What is my value to the world if it's not in my one deep expertise? And that was really hard to come to make that decision of like, I'm going to stop doing that in favor of this other thing that I'm not an expert in, but could become one and has more potential.
It sounds to me, Mike, like there was an element of, oh no, I'm so wedded, like identity-wise, to this expertise that I bring to bear. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering also, were you thinking like, I'm going to kind of have a quasi boss? Like, I can't just do whatever I want anymore. I have to check with someone else and we have to make joint decisions now, which slows things down. And there's a level of accountability, let's say, that wasn't present before. Was that on your mind as well?
Yeah, I wasn't so much worried about the having to check with someone else or like, I knew I wouldn't be going into a partnership with a boss per se. To me, I saw it as there's going to be someone holding me accountable for the things that I'm agreeing to do, but the reverse is also true. So when Corey came to the table with this, it's not like he wasn't going to have the exact same issues that I was having. Like a lot of the same questions are coming up for him of, well, if he's joining me, then like I'm going to be his quasi boss. And so both of us had the same questions. Ultimately, we decided that we actually are extraordinarily complementary in terms of skills and personality. So the things that we were really good at, the other was not. And the things we're really that I'm really bad at, Corey is fantastic at, and vice versa. In essence, that was all there, but we really didn't have to worry about it too much just because of the nature of our partnership.
So Mike, now can you take some time to tell us all the things that you're not good at? I'm kidding. We don't.
I mean, well, since we're already here, how long do we have again?
We have maybe not enough time, but close, since you're so good at so many things. So one thing we were talking about coming into this is the AWS side of the business. Certainly, we want to cover both sides of the business in this conversation, but I know that you sell to enterprise level companies, or at least you're doing more complicated sales, big ticket prices. And First of all, I'm curious, how do you define enterprise, just for the listeners?
That one is hard to define. And the reason for that is the U.S. government, I forget what department, but what some department there, Department of Labor probably, actually defines what enterprise means. And it's like 500 employees or half a billion in revenue. I'm sorry, a quarter billion, something like that. It's not a lot.
I'm looking at Gartner and they say small business is less than 50 million.
There you go. That's what it was.
Mid-market is 50 million to 1 billion. And then enterprise would be a billion or more.
Okay. So I think that's actually different from the U.S. government's definition, but we'll go with Gartner because they've been around a while. Under Gartner's definition, we sell mostly in the mid-market to lower end of the enterprise. Most people define enterprise, and how I define enterprise is one of those things of I know it when I see it. Like enterprise can't be defined solely based on revenue. It's really defined based on complexity. That's hard to quantify. Like how complex is a company? Like, can you put a number on that? Oh, maybe, maybe not. But when you go into a company and you say, how many approval steps does it take for you to buy a book on the company dime? And they're like the employee's eyes glaze over. You've probably hit an enterprise company.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I was looking at some research the other day that says that the average enterprise sale involves 6.8 stakeholders and or decision makers. That sounds about right to me.
One of my challenges is that I've never not done enterprise sales. Every deal I've ever been in, every company I've ever worked for has always been involved in enterprise sales. Like the smallest deals that I've done, the smallest deals I've been involved in, were still like three or four stakeholders involved. So when I hear all this advice, especially out of the freelancing world, of if you haven't met someone who can say yes and you haven't gone high enough, it's like, well, no, the companies that I work with, even the CEO still can't say yes unilaterally to the things that I'm trying to do because they still need the team buy-in. So while they may have the technical authority to say yes, they don't have the political authority. And that's often way more important.
Well, yeah, and I think you're making an important contrast here, which is typically in a small business, you can just talk to the person who writes the check and they can make a unilateral decision. The larger the company, what I find is it tends to be a lot more consensus driven.
Right.
So, Mike, what's the, in terms of like a sales process, what's the shortest one you've ever seen in the enterprise environment? I think this might be helpful for listeners to further contextualize it and define it however you want, you know, length or number of phone calls or number of meetings, whatever.
I have an outlier that I will say because it's kind of funny and because you both know about enterprise deals as well. I had one that closed in 7 days.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I love Liston's response to that. It's like, I'm sorry, what did you say? Seven?
Yeah, let's throw that one out. What's the next lowest?
So the next lowest after that was probably 3 months. And that involved a meeting every other week with different people. All told, I think the entire number of stakeholders was probably 8 or 9 people involved.
Yeah. And so just for the folks at home, that's an easy enterprise sale. That's like a quick and easy and dirty.
We just had a company come to us today that we have been courting for 3 years. And they finally came to us today and said, we've got budget. We'd like to talk.
That's great.
And it's like, this is a huge win for us, but it really does take that long. A lot of these enterprise deals for us will take months and months. And it's not just like one person, it's a dozen people.
I mean, to me, that raises all kinds of interesting questions that some of which are under this umbrella of like bootstrapping. Like, how do you get started if you want to go after those kind of clients? You've got to have what? A year of runway to even sanely go down that road, right?
Yep, absolutely. That's exactly what my business partner and I did independently. When we went off on our own, we both had in excess of a year runway. And then we also both had one single large whale client that we were working with. And that allowed us to have a little bit more confidence that cash was not just going to suddenly stop. But we then had to put all of our effort right away into getting more clients, knowing that those clients are going to take a very long time to close.
Mike, just for context here, about like what, you don't have to reveal your prices, but what is kind of the range? Like, is it tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands? And how many clients were you trying to acquire in a year?
Right now, our pricing starts in mid five figures, and then it goes up from there. We generally want to try to target about 1 to 2 clients a month, but we're also not hitting that at the moment. We're a little bit under that still.
Wow. Okay. So yeah, this takes a while, everybody listening.
It does take quite some time. Last year, this might be a really interesting point. Enterprises have sales cycles themselves, like when they decide to buy things. And for the consulting I did last year that I don't do anymore, what I found is that the sales cycle for me was no one's going to do anything in Q1 because they have new budget, which is great, but they're still getting people on board. And it's going to take a while to get the political capital built up to say, all right, let's do a thing. Q3, nothing's happening because it's summer. Q4, nothing's happening because it's a bunch of holidays in December. So all of my revenue happened for the entire year in Q2. So I would make all of my money in 1 quarter and then not get paid for 9 months.
Yeah. Thinking about like fisher.
It takes a while to get
people work on fishing boats in Alaska. That reminds me of that sort of dynamic. It's like, well, you know, we'll pay you when the job's done.
Yeah. So basically I would spend my entire year getting deals to the point where they could possibly close somewhere in Q2 because they're not going to close anytime outside of that. And that just happened to be the sales cycles for what I was working on. What I'm doing now has a different sales cycle that I haven't quite figured out yet. It still takes just as long. I just don't have enough data to say what month are they going to close.
Can you say more about this idea of getting the deals to the point where they could close in Q2 or wherever you are in the point of year? But how do you know, like, what are the characteristics of a deal that could close?
It's really hard to say, mostly because you're having so many conversations just with like everyone. When I go into a deal, I'm not talking with one person. And I kind of said this, but I really want to actually clarify a point here. In an enterprise deal, you have people inside that are the champion. What that means is they are actually advocating for you on your behalf inside the company, whether you know it or not. Their job is internally to move your deal forward for you. So I will check in with my champion as much as I need to. Now, this might be weekly, and that might be a weekly call with them just to understand exactly what's going on. Beyond that, that means that I may have a bunch of other meetings that I'm setting up as well with people they're recommending me to. So what all this really means is as I'm making all these different contacts and all these different meetings, I'm taking a lot of notes and I'm asking a lot of questions about like, why do you want this? What are you looking to do? What blockers can I help get out of the way? What are we still waiting on? And after a while, you start to see that these blockers that were there a month ago are now slowly being eroded. So the entire point of getting a deal to the point where it could close is you get to the point where they now have everything they need to say yes, and all they need to do is just do it. It's really hard to say objectively, like from the outside, what that looks like. You will know it when you see it. But the only way to actually get there is to go out and have those conversations and have a lot of them.
That seems like an interesting point to elaborate on. So you just go knocking door to door, right? I'm kidding.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think folks are going to hear that. Oh, you have a lot of conversations. And on one level, you're like, yeah, makes sense. And at another level, the next question is like, how the heck do you do that? Can you kind of elaborate on how that actually works for you guys?
So I have watched my business partner work, and my business partner does a lot of our initial sales work. And a lot of sales work at this level looks like just fucking around online. A lot of time is spent in various community Slacks. It's spent on the phone just talking about various problems. It's spent hanging around on conference floors. And then eventually you get this kind of someone kind of sidles up on sideways and says, you want to come in and talk to someone at my company? And at that point, you know, you've got your in. Well, you might've been cultivating that for months already. So how do you have all these conversations? Well, it just takes a while and it looks like you're just screwing around, and often it feels like you're just screwing around, but you never know where the deal is going to come from.
What's interesting about what you just said there, Mike, is you don't really have an account-based strategy. You're not saying, okay, these 20 companies, you're saying, if we go to these communities and be helpful there, or at least be a presence in this community, we know that we'll probably be in front of some of the right people. But I think one of the challenges with that, certainly if I were listening to this, well, I guess I technically am, I would be thinking, how much time do I need to put in before I can determine if this is time well spent or not? Like, does it take 3 months, 6 months, 12 months? Like, it seems like an experiment for every single one of these communities, and I only have so many hours in the day.
Yeah, and that was one of the reasons why we merged, is so that we were able to split that between the two of us. I wish I had a better answer on that one, but it really just does take a lot of time. What we had going for us is that both my business partner and I are experts in what we do already. We're very, very experienced in this world. So we were already somewhat known as far as who we were, just kind of like they know us as people, not by the work that we do in these communities. Like, we were already part of the communities. We already knew the kinds of people that were there. So we knew they were viable. At that point, it was just upping how much we were involved in that particular community and seeing what came of it.
I'm going to be purposefully obtuse here in how I phrase this. So is there really no strategy, or is it really just like random, like hanging out with the right kind of people? Again, I'm being a little obtuse.
A lot of it is. A lot of it actually really does look like just us hanging out. Some of them are more strategic. Like, there are certain communities that we will spend a lot of time in, and others will pop in from time to time.
Is that just kind of a like observe feedback loop where you just like, oh, seems like we get a lot of traction here, we should spend more time here, that kind of thing?
Basically, there are some communities that we'll be hanging around and notice that there are a lot of higher level people in the community. And for us, junior engineers are not our market. They don't have enough sway at the levels that we need to make a solid introduction, which is what we're gunning for. So we're really looking for people at very senior levels. And some communities have a whole lot of junior people, and some have a whole lot of senior people. The problem with how can you tell from the outside? Like, once you get in there, how do you know whether it's like a handful of really senior people that are just really active and everyone else is junior, or if it's actually a whole bunch of senior people? And that one came with experience.
So you just have to try to see.
Right. So we just hung out there and see what came of it.
So when you say community, you mean something online? And what do you say is the split between, oh, we do it online versus we hop on a plane and go to a conference?
Right now, we're doing a lot of conferences, just because it's conference season right now. Mm-hmm. I think it's about a conference a week at the moment.
Yikes.
Yeah. It will get less than that very soon. And then in fall, it'll go back up to about a conference a week. So during those downtimes, we're spending a lot of time online. And online is probably where we spend the bulk of our time, just because it's asynchronous, so we can do it whenever.
Yeah.
Twitter works pretty well for building that too. It's not nearly as high signal, but being active on Twitter has worked out pretty well.
Can you give an example of maybe another place? So like, we talked about Slack communities. I'm big on LinkedIn. That's to say I'm an advocate, not I'm famous on LinkedIn. But a lot of people ask me about groups on LinkedIn, and I personally haven't used them much because they seem very underutilized. So I'm wondering, where do you go when you're looking for communities? What are some categories?
LinkedIn is one we haven't started experimenting with that one yet. I really want to, and it's on my list to, in the next couple months, to set up some sort of LinkedIn strategy. Beyond that, so Slack, Twitter, and there are a couple of private forums that we're on. I mean, not really private. They're forums. They're very niche forums. So we're on those. Not a lot of them anymore. It's just not getting the traction that we found they used to have. And Reddit has worked out pretty well, too.
That's the surprise for me in the group.
Reddit? Really?
Well, I did get my first client ever as a self-employed person through Reddit, so maybe I shouldn't be surprised. But yeah, a little bit surprised there. Because, I mean, I'm thinking what's going to be most effective, or like the heuristic in my mind for what would be an effective community for you to participate in would have some senior people. And I'm just having trouble imagining like a VP of anything being on Reddit.
You would be surprised. And what's weird about my particular world is that the people in leadership positions did not just come out of other leadership roles. They actually generally come up through engineering. So they're still engineers at heart. They still have some involvement in day-to-day engineering. So it's not that they are still hanging out at Reddit. They may also be looking at places that are not engineering focused because they're now in leadership. They're looking for leadership based stuff. So there are a few communities that we're active in that are a lot of leadership communities, but have a large focus on engineering. That one's been pretty interesting. We get quite a bit of traction in those.
That's super interesting.
Those are really hard to find.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's quite the niche.
It really is. Like trying to find a leadership community is already hard enough. And then I want to find an engineering community, which also hard. Now I want to find a community that has both of those. We're like, right.
Well, and also a leadership community that's not aspirational. Like,
right.
I would think a ton of them have, you know, future leaders of America kind of thing, where it's like people want to be leaders and they're trying to learn how to become a leader, but they aren't necessarily a leader now.
Yeah, exactly. And that was one of the challenges in finding where to spend time is a lot of the places you go are definitely aspirational and don't appear so until you're actually in there. Choosing where we spend time is, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of experimentation. It feels wasteful from time to time. We do track what we get out of it, but if I were to run the numbers on it, it would probably look negative. And invariably, every time we think, hey, should we just like stop being involved there? We get some deal out of it.
Yeah, I'm really interested in those activities that seem wasteful, but when they have a hit, it's a big one.
Yeah, and what's interesting is that we just need one hit for it to all be worth it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm also interested in the other end of the spectrum stuff that's like reliably effective at a smaller scale. But innovation seems to be one of those things that's wasteful. But when it's a hit, it really makes a difference.
So reliably for us, like the most reliable thing to generate deals for us is conferences and meetups. We have to speak at them. Otherwise, it doesn't work.
Well, so one thing I want to challenge you on, Mike, you said if you had one hit, it'll all be worth it. But you also said you want to develop 1 to 2 brand new clients every single month. It doesn't seem to me, based on those two pieces of information, that if it works out once, it's all worth it. You need something that needs to work, let's say, every other month at a minimum. And then you have 2 to 4 channels that you're working.
Right. That is true. And that's why we have multiple communities we're involved in and also doing conferences and meetups.
I see.
So what's interesting is we ask every new lead that comes to us, where'd you hear about us? And it's never one place. The answer is almost always, you know, I'm not really sure. Like you just seem to be everywhere. So I think the strategy is working. We're just overwhelming everyone with our presence.
I feel a little overwhelmed with your presence right now, in a good way.
That's how I wanted it.
And that was my winning strategy with my wife, and she married me, so it can work.
Just be everywhere all at once. Got it.
And overwhelm. I think the key for me was overwhelming.
So one of the things we, Liston and I, talk about too much, I think, for our audience's taste, maybe, is this idea of brand versus direct response marketing. So when I think of like someone who's everywhere, I start to think, oh, they're establishing a brand. Is that how you guys think about yourselves now? Or where do you kind of fit into that spectrum?
So we are trying to establish a brand. If you go to our website, lastweekinaws.com, you will notice that we have a very awesome platypus. We lovingly refer to the platypus as the gangster platypus. Some people refer to the platypus as extraordinarily judgy, which, yeah, that's about right.
Somehow I'm thinking of Corey when I think of the platypus.
I know, right? So we are trying to build a brand, and this design is actually fairly new, but a month or so old. So the intention is to build a brand around everything we're doing, and therefore being everywhere is a It's how brand marketing generally is going to work. We don't do a lot of direct response. The reason for that is direct response for us doesn't sell high ticket consulting, because the people that we need in the room are never all going to be in the room when they're buying something through a direct response. We could use some sort of foothold strategy, and that's something we're investigating, like selling a smaller ticket item to someone on that team, like a course, ebook, whatever. So we are looking at that. We're not quite there yet. And in general, engineering doesn't respond well to direct response anyways. So we're very cautious about using it.
Yeah. I share a lot of those. They're not like general concerns. They're just more situational, where I think there's a lot of situations where direct response is not quite the right look for expertise.
Yeah. For us, I'm not really convinced that it's going to be the thing for us. I think our brand marketing works really well. We have a pretty strong referral game. So beyond that, I think direct response might be supplemental at best. That's my hunch.
One of the things that's so interesting to me about your business, about Corey's, is the role that a newsletter played in the early formative days. In the way you guys did your newsletter, I would characterize as very generous. It was an act of service to a specific community. It was started with, I don't know, I'm about to find out how much commercial intent there was, but it was started in a spirit of generosity is how I would characterize it. And it just seems to have played an outsized role in helping you bootstrap. So two questions, am I seeing that right? And then the second question is, your sponsors, do they see their sponsorship as a brand or a direct response thing?
So on the first question, yeah, that's about right. We both started it not with the intention to make money off of it, but as an intention of, we know things about this topic. The newsletters were a monitoring topic in AWS, and we know things about this topic. We want to share it with other people because this topic is not being talked about enough. We were the only ones in the market to be doing it. So we're like, well, let's just do a newsletter. And over time, we started getting sponsorships. We never realized that sponsorship was a monetization strategy that would actually work. And so our intention was never, we're going to retire off of this sponsorship revenue. It was the money we were getting from it is, that's nice beer money. Now that we kind of wised up and realized that we actually have something really valuable here, to the sponsors too, we started taking sponsorships seriously. And now I do a lot of direct outreach to sponsors to get more sponsors in. My follow-up game is just like totally next level at this point. So I'm following up with potential sponsors 1, 2, 3 times a day, like different sponsors. Like I eventually set up Pipedrive to do my CRM stuff entirely because of sponsors, not the consulting. So all of that said, the sponsorship revenue it's non-trivial at this point. It covers our baseline expenses for the business, like just with sponsorships alone. So everything beyond that, aka consulting, is just gravy. And that is incredibly freeing, knowing that if I just keep doing all these newsletters and podcasts, we're going to be fine. Like, that's great.
So your sponsors, do they see like paying you money as an exercise in direct response or brand marketing or?
Yeah. So some of them, it depends on the sponsor. Part of my sales pitch now is to explain very briefly what direct response is and what brand marketing is. And all these people are marketers. They understand the distinction between the two. What a lot of them don't really understand is that when you put a link in a newsletter, yes, I have data around it. I can tell you how many times it gets clicked. And of course, they have UTM tags on their end or a landing page that's tracking visits. So they know the analytics too. However, just because you have these analytics does not mean that you should then try to measure it as direct response. Under no circumstances is this direct response. It is much more brand marketing. So just because you have the data doesn't mean you should use it. And that can be difficult to sell with some companies. Some companies are like, yes, absolutely, we're totally on board. Others, say they're on board and then start asking you for metrics later, and you find out they're not really on board. They just say they are.
Hmm. Interesting.
Well, this kind of goes back to some of the things we're talking about in the enterprise sale and the stakeholders and really understanding what they want. And I think how they're evaluated, that's a question I ask a lot of people when I'm talking to them, is like, what do you need to show to convince everybody else that this was a fantastic decision? And if they're like, direct response numbers, Mike Julian should say, never mind, we're not going to be a good fit for you.
Yeah. And I have absolutely done that with a couple.
And do you find that they're honest with you when you ask that question?
Most of them don't actually know how to answer the question.
Uh-huh.
Which is not a good sign, but it's also not a bad one. It means that they may not be returning customers.
Right.
The ones who know how to answer it and give a good answer of, like, they say, no, this is very much brand marketing for us, they're still clients to this day. And like, they've been clients since day one, or sponsors rather. And then there's others that are, before I started asking the question, I can look back and say, you know, probably should have never taken them as a sponsor.
I wanted to go back quickly, Mike, to, I know we're all over the place here, but I wanted to go back to your AWS consulting.
Yeah.
And it sounds to me like, are your engagements one-off, or is there follow-on work that you have with those clients?
Yeah. This is something that my business partner and I are actually going into more depth on tomorrow. We blocked out the entire day for a partner strategy session, or like a company strategy session. Right now, our consulting is one-offs. We come in, we do an assessment, we save you a whole boatload of money, give you the reports, give you a presentation, answer some questions. Thanks, see you later. And that's cool because they're fun to do and it both sides win massively. But they're one-offs. So like after that, we have to go find a completely new client. And as it turns out, like that's not awesome for us. Right. We actually, from a business perspective, like we have, what is that, 100% churn?
Yeah, exactly.
So that's not cool. But on top of that, a lot of the companies that we're working with are actually really awesome companies. We would love to work with them more. Like we like their teams. So it's kind of a bummer when we come in and we're like, well, we're done. See ya. And some of them are like, wait a minute. Like, what do you mean you're leaving? So we started offering a new service where it's a monthly, I don't want to say it's a retainer because it's not a retainer in like the Jonathan Stark, Philip Morgan sense. It's more like a, we call it the bill monitoring service, a really boring name. But the idea is that now that we've done this huge assessment for you, let us be experts and like pay attention to your bill and pay attention to your AWS spend on a monthly or a week to week basis and make recommendations as it comes. One of the things, and the reason this all works, is when you cut the bill, it's not going to stay cut. Because your company is growing, the bill will increase again. And that's fine. That is to be expected. Where it gets really tricky is why this is a good thing is, though we just, let's say we cut $1 million off your bill, you're going to end up spending more than $1 million back probably over the next year or so. And that's fine because you're actually spending the money more wisely. So it's more effective use of your money. Great. Well, as you continue to grow, engineers will make decisions on how to use services, how to make connections, things like this that are suboptimal. And they're not always obvious. So it's like, well, if I put this server over here and have it talk to this server on like this other place over here, the communication between them is 3 times more expensive than if they were sitting together. And it's not always obvious to people. Well, we can catch that sort of thing. So we started offering the service. So now we have a monthly option. We're experimenting with the idea of having a very expensive video course as well that basically gives the foundations of what we do, but you can buy it as a self-paced video set instead of hiring us to do consulting. That will allow us to get a lot of people who can't afford the consulting or say politically just can't hire consultants to still get the benefit of working with us.
I have so many thoughts about that, but the reason I asked the question was when I think about an enterprise sale and you pointed out your fastest sale of all time was 3 months, and you were having like multiple conversations every week during that time in order to bring it to fruition. Enterprise selling is always very expensive.
Yes.
And of course we can make up for that because we can charge higher fees because we're dealing with organizations that have the wherewithal to pay them. But it does, it really helps the case, and it helps your profitability if once you're in, you have something else to sell them as well. So like I'm seeing this with a client I have right now. And in fact, while we were on this conversation, I got another email from my champion at that company who's like, look, you got another referral. So one challenge I see with the core business model you guys have is there's a perception that once you go in and you solve that AWS bill problem, they're like, okay, we're good. We'd still like to have them around, but we only need them to do the big job once every so often. Whereas if I'm training salespeople or people involved in sales, even indirectly, there's thousands of people at the company who could use training and like more than I could ever fulfill. And so I think anybody listening to this should consider, like, can you charge enough on the front end if you're not selling multiple things to make up for it?
Right. We will never be in a position where we will always have widgets to sell you. What we're doing is it's not something you always need. The problem will not always be there. And a lot of the companies we're going into were through us doing this. They've actually learned a lot by working with us. So in a lot of cases, we don't need to stick around because they know how to do it. With our bill monitoring service, we are still there. We are still helping out. And part of that service is actually we're offering kind of a architect on retainer sort of service as like the high-end offering for it. So that keeps us more engaged. Like that's the ultimate engagement in the account. But even then, like they're still not going to always need us because the job of the consultant is to basically teach your clients. They shouldn't always rely on you. So we're sharing our knowledge, we're teaching them as we go, and eventually working ourselves out of a job, which I'm kind of fine with, but it does make it more expensive in client acquisition because eventually we have to go get new clients. We can't just have the same five clients forever.
One of the interesting things that we're kind of dancing around here is the idea of profitability. For one, you can't start a business like you have without runway or a sort of anchor client that gives you some free time to spend building the business. And you can't sustain it without a certain level of profitability. So I'm curious how you and Corey think about profitability, or maybe he doesn't think about that at all since you're the CEO. But how do you guys think about that?
We both actually do think about profitability quite a bit. We're careful about the engagements that we do take on. There are certain clients that we just won't work with, like entire classes of clients, like entire classes of problems, because they are, though they are revenue, they're not profitable revenue. And also we don't like doing them. So things like a lot of their sponsors also ask us to do content writing for them. And though we are very capable of doing that, we're just not that interested in it because it takes a lot of effort and it's not very profitable for us. So super low margin compared to, say, sponsorships, which are very high margin for us, or consulting, which is like super high margin for us. So on top of that, with every deal, how we price things, we build profit into the pricing up front, and we do that, and it's a very conscious decision. On the back end, on like accounting side, we actually follow the profit first principles by Michael something another. So right off the top on every deal we do, it's all the money that comes in is, I think we set aside 10 or 20% directly to profit and then start divvying up everything else after that. And then over time, we'll crank that up.
Yeah. So do you think about profitability, like, do you kind of do the math on an hourly basis or more on like, well, we made this much and spent this much this year and paid ourselves this much salary? I'm kind of curious, without sharing specific numbers, just more mechanically how you approach it.
Yeah. When Corey and I were consulting individually, we both have about the same amount of experience doing it. And we were definitely pricing things on an hourly. It's not that we were pricing hourly. We were pricing on a fixed fee, but calculating our effective hourly rate from that. And we were using that number to figure out the pricing. now we have it so dialed in that we will look at a deal and say, that feels about X. And we'll toss that back and forth and like rough out the options, like what each option on the proposal is going to get you. And the numbers may change, but usually not significantly so. So we have a pretty good idea of what a thing should cost, which has a lot of profit built into it. And if we were to go back and do the math on it, we're actually getting, or the deals, the engagements we're working on are getting more profitable. So I think we've gotten pretty good at it.
Yeah, I bet. How are you driving the increase in profitability? Is it better clients? Is it better efficiency? What does that look like?
Both of those primarily. Okay. One of the first things I did was when Corey and I first started working together, first thing I did, I started going on a bunch of sales calls that he was doing, and I didn't really participate in them. I just watched. And then about 2 or 3 weeks into it, I sent Corey this Google Doc and I said, hey, here's a process for doing sales, for doing this consulting sale. He goes, oh, I don't want to follow a process. And I'm like, no. It's not you following a process. This is what you already do. I just wrote it down. So like, then we start looking at it and we're like, oh, wow. You know, if we asked these two questions in reverse, then it would actually lead to all these other questions that we want to get to, but that we never do. So like, it'll actually answer a whole bunch of stuff for us and make the meeting go quicker. It'll be much more effective, and it will set us up for later questions that have always been harder to ask. Like one of the things that we changed early on was we really want to get a copy of your AWS bill before we sign a contract with you. Having that allows us to know if we can help or not. Some people are averse to sending such things. Like if I ask you to send me your cell phone bill, would you do that? You might kind of pause a bit and maybe think about who you called last month. So it's the same situation, but there are certain, if I structure our conversation in such a way that by the time I get to that ask, it's just a no-brainer for you, then that's what we want to do. And that's what we ended up getting to. So it worked out really well. So once we had all this written down, we could identify where we could make the sales operation more efficient. So that increases profitability once we do get the sell. On the back end, on delivery, I started writing up how we actually deliver, like step by step, this is how you do this consulting engagement. And then we could see ways that we could optimize that to make it quicker to do. And one of our next steps is probably going to be writing some internal software to make that even quicker.
You're kind of like the coach playing back the tape of the football team, like in the most positive way, and identifying these opportunities for improvement.
Yeah, so I alluded to this at the start of this call that my strengths are actually in process improvement and systems. I am good at sales. I'm good at marketing, but they're definitely not my strongest areas. Corey is naturally good at sales, but he doesn't have any official training in sales. While I sort of do, but I'm just not naturally good at the conversations, whereas he is a very personal person. So together, he can make a conversation go perfect. But he will not always handle the objections well. Well, I do because I have an analytical approach to things. I understand when I see an objection what they're really thinking. So I can come back and say, oh, well, actually, if you ask this thing instead, you'll handle that objection next time.
That's interesting. I'm super curious for Liston's take on the idea of like watching the tape.
I mean, I think it's really valuable. And in fact, I wish that all of my clients would record their calls and send them to me, because I would be able to give them such actionable insights probably 10 times faster than them relying on their own memory of what happens. I think it's enormously valuable. And I was curious about, you said you may write some internal software in order to accelerate the delivery process. Is that something you would plan to keep internal as just an efficiency gain and then protect and not allow people to go sign up? And now you guys are a software business as well.
You know, I'm not really sure. If anything, we'd probably actually give it away for free. And the reason for that is we would be writing software that we have competitors that do this, but they're SaaS companies. We're the only one in the space to do it as a consulting offering, which is often why we get clients. They come to us of, they'll say, well, we have this SaaS software, but it's not meeting all of our needs because of X, Y, and Z. So we would like you to help. So part of our pitch is we don't replace the SaaS software, we augment it. We're complementary to it. So if we were to write software, it would actually be that same software, at which point we could give it away for free because it's not our core business, and undercut competitors at the same time.
You're a bad man, Mike Julian.
I am. I will have to say that the idea was given to me by a venture capital friend of mine. You can all blame the VCs for that one.
Who obviously had not invested in one of these competitors, otherwise he would not have given you that advice.
Clearly.
Yeah, interesting. So does this mean, based on what you were saying about you and Corey and kind of how you split the sales process, does that mean you're both selling now? Because you said he's good at sort of the pitching and getting people excited, but he's not so good at handling the objections. Like, is there a handoff, or that seems kind of weird?
It can be weird. So generally how it's working right now, and I think we've settled on this process is working for us, is Corey will do all of the initial, I guess, the initial lead gathering of, like, he will be at the conferences, he'll be in these communities and watering holes, and a lead comes in and he will do the first call. Sometimes I'm on it, sometimes I'm not. But it will always lead to more calls later, and I'm generally on those. So we joke internally that Corey brings them in and I close them.
I see. So he's doing kind of the lead gen part, but he's not actually doing like two sales meetings and then Mike comes in to be bad cop and like crush all their objections.
No, we don't do any of that. More often than not, we are both on every sales call, and it's, we do have our different strengths and those come out in the sales call. That one was difficult to learn how to do well, because we would always have like Slack open in the background saying, hey, we're like typing to each other, you take this next question, I know it's coming up, or like, hang on, I have a perfect answer for what he just asked. And now we don't really have that because we understand who's going to say what's going to happen next. So it was a bit of a dance, and now we've gotten pretty good at it. But a huge tip that I can give there is we really wanted to figure out how could we hand off a question to the other without being obvious that we were doing it. So things like if someone asks this really in-depth AWS billing question, I probably can't answer it. So I want to have Corey answer it. But sometimes Corey may think that it's not actually as in-depth as it would seem, so he won't say anything, expecting me to answer. So at first we're like, oh shit, like what if that happens? It's going to be really awkward. And finally we're like, well, why don't we just say, hey, Corey, take that question. And
a very elegant solution.
Right. So that's what we did. Like, now we're to the point where, you know, Corey, I think Corey has a fantastic answer for that. And it works out well every time. And our fear was that it would come across as unprofessional, except I don't think it does. I think it's actually quite the opposite of that. Like, no one in the meeting room on the other side is thinking one person in the room has all the answers.
Yeah. I mean, that strikes me as something that happens all the time on the client side, is they're like, oh, why don't you take this one?
And we just got so in our heads over it. The solution was just get out of our own heads.
Well, and Mike, you come from a very complicated, complex kind of software world. Like, all the tools you would have bought for monitoring are pretty complicated, and often in those sales, you have what's called a solutions architect, right? Someone who's there to support the complex engineering side of the sale. Like, let's convince Mike that we can make all this stuff work. And I've found when I've been in calls that where a solutions architect is present, that constantly happens, where the AE is like, why don't you handle this one? Or the solutions architect will be like, I'll take this one, and then you chime in if you have anything to add. Like, they're openly communicating back and forth.
Yeah. I don't know why it took us so long to come to that realization that, no, this is actually fine, but it definitely did. So my advice is just get out of your own heads and things go so much better.
I'm wondering how much silence I can create here.
Well, we'll never know because you broke it.
I know.
Is that like sales 101, Philip?
Is what you just said sales 101?
Yeah, like you can't handle the silence. He who speaks first loses.
Well,
that's how it goes.
I don't mind being the loser here, because in this company, that still makes me a winner.
That was one of the tips about sales that my dad taught me many, many, many years ago. My dad came from the old school door-to-door sales.
Oh, wow.
Was you sit down with the salesperson, you ask them for what you want, and then you shut up. And his tip was, he who speaks first loses. And I watched him do it with car salesmen all the time, just for fun and giggles.
It's funny, we're talking about this. So I don't agree with the notion that the person who speaks first loses.
No, I don't either.
I do think that if you want your client's true reaction, especially after you give a price, the best thing to do is be quiet until they respond.
Right.
And then you'll get their true feelings. Otherwise, and the other thing, of course, as you know, Mike, most people who fill in the silence will start to justify why they're worth it, or like how happy their last client was. And that just sounds like a position of weakness.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the small, small tip, but especially for in-person sales, don't smile when you name your price.
Why is that?
The problem with it is, people will pick up on it, and they will often take it as you trying to justify it. It's almost always associated with an uptick in your voice at the same time. Like, oh, this will be $10,000. And you just grin ear to ear. And everyone, it's just like, really? Like, you look like you've never quoted that price before. Instead, if you just say it, I mean, not really deadpan, but you just be confident and say it seriously, then it's always worked out so much better.
The games we play, dear friend.
Seriously.
Well, Philip, I think I'm good. Do you have any other questions or things you want to pepper Mike with before we head out?
I think we've done some serious extraction on Mike's brain. There's more there. I know there is, but
there always is.
This covered some new ground. Like, I've interviewed Mike, I don't know how many times now.
This is three or four.
Feels like three to me.
I think it might be three.
And this was covered some new ground. So I'm delighted. I feel like we can release him now from his shackles and his podcast shackles.
Yay.
Well, Mike, you're free to go. One day soon, we will have to get some Matt's barbecue.
Fun story. I'm doing it on Thursday. Sorry.
Oh, you are with Dan.
Yeah, with Dan. In fact, I think we're going to send you photos to make you feel bad.
I won't feel bad because I'm leaving for Italy the next day. So enjoy your Matt's barbecue, buddy.
We're still going to do it.
Okay.
You'll still feel guilty.
I was going to say, good luck trying to get listening to feel bad.
Right. Yes, I'm a sociopath. I have no feelings whatsoever. Mike, thank you so much for being here.
Absolutely.
We appreciate not only that you're our guest, but that you're our first guest. And it's hard to imagine that this could have gone much better for our first guest. So wonderful. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. Happy to hear it.
Now, before we go, is there anything you'd like the listeners to do, to find you, to get a hold of you, to never contact you, any of that?
Yeah. So you can all find me at lastweekinaws.com. That's the Last Week in AWS newsletter. It also has links to the services we do. And if you're of a application monitoring bent, if that's your jam, you can find that at monitoring.love. Yes, that really is a TLD, and it's awesome. You can also find me on Twitter at Mike_Julian. That's Julian.
Excellent. And that'll all be linked in the show notes. Mike, thanks for being here, man. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much, Mike.
Yeah, thank you. Absolutely.